Hello everyone, and welcome to the Institute of Leadership and Management's weekly news roundup podcast, where we take a critical look at a number of topical developments from the past few days with the leadership and management theme. I'm Rod Jones, content manager at the Institute, and in this podcast we will be looking at news up to the 11th of October 2019. Joining me to analyse these stories is Kate Cooper, Head of Research, Policy and Standards at the Institute. Hello, Kate.
Hello, Rod.
Our first story looks at the findings of the latest Race at Work survey by Business in the Community. Business in the Community Race Campaign Director Sandra Kerr said employers are making progress within their organisations to ensure that they are truly the best places to work for employees from all backgrounds and ethnicities. However, in order to achieve a fairer workplace in the UK, we need to encourage all employees to hold themselves accountable and to be transparent about where they are and what direction they are headed. Kate, what action should employees take to ensure that their zero tolerance policies are not simply words on a page?
Well, this is a really good example of that gap that we have between ambition, which is stated targets for inclusion and the policies that we're going to adopt and the strategies we're going to put in place, and the actuality, the experience of underrepresented groups. And this report doesn't paint this in a very good picture. And you might remember, Rod, the research that we did last year where we looked at banter. It's those informal communications where people can, whatever policy you have in place, however proactive you are, whatever positive action you take with your recruitment, if the workplace is made to feel uncomfortable because of the daily interactions that people have with each other. So when there are calls for zero tolerance of racist bullying in the workplace, what does that really mean? Does it mean we have a great grievance procedure, or does it mean that we really engage with those informal communications between people? We raise awareness of the impact of some what are thought to be innocuous remarks on feelings of being included and feeling of being part of the workplace.
Thank you very much, Kate. Our next story asks, should equality depend upon philanthropy? Melinda Gates has revealed in a column for Time magazine that she is ploughing £1 billion of her own cash into expanding the influence of women throughout the US, particularly in the world of work. In 2018, she writes, it's frustrating, even heartbreaking, to confront evidence of the many ways our country continues to hold women back. As such, her £1 billion will go towards three initiatives: dismantling barriers to female advancement by tackling discrimination, fast-tracking women in sectors with outsized social impacts, such as technology and the media, mobilising shareholders, consumers and employees to amplify external pressure on firms in need of reform. Gates writes that gender equality in the US has been chronically underfunded, and that although £1 billion is a lot of money, she recognises that it's only a small fraction of what's necessary and hopes that her action will be seen as an invitation for others to join the cause and make commitments of their own. Kate, is there a risk that this could be misinterpreted and encourage leaders to think that equality is only possible with the help of large-scale philanthropic gestures rather than action at grassroots level within organisations?
I think it does sort of put it in the nice-to-have category. Oh, we'd like equality, but sadly we can't afford it. But if we look at her three initiatives, I think the one that's the most powerful and probably the one that would cost the least is the mobilisation of shareholders, consumers and employees. We've seen how powerful a group the Google employees were when they were coming out protesting about what they perceived to be injustice. And if we recognise that that is where the real power to change things come from people saying, I'm not going to buy from this organisation. They aren't inclusive. They have poor equality policies. And that's much more about awareness raising rather than some of those more formal, expensive training programmes or outreach programmes that she's referring to. You can see even £1 billion won't go very far if you're actually trying to put structural changes in place. I mean, as we've seen with the racism at work, they're not necessarily successful, but really trying to mobilise investors, people who work in organisations, to question the status quo and to be part of, you know, be the change you want to be, I think is something fantastic. And that isn't philanthropy. That's being a 21st century citizen.
Thank you, Kate. Our next story considers a McKinsey article by Michael Lurie and Laura Tegelberg that calls for a new approach to leadership in today's complex business environment. That is, today's leaders must focus on co-creating meaningful value with and for all stakeholders and play the roles of visionary, architect, coach, and catalyst. The traditional roles, while still available to leaders when needed, become woven into the way people work. As a visionary, leaders will shape the emergence of a clear, compelling purpose and vision that emerges from the organisation by observing and listening to people throughout the system. And as architects, leaders will provide clarity on what is to be accomplished. Leaders as coaches will need to encourage a wide range of formal and informal learning initiatives and build coaching into their team interactions by asking more questions and prescribing solutions. And as catalysts, leaders will work, for example, to remove roadblocks that prevent empowered teams from bringing ideas to reality. Kate, how do these roles fit with the Institute's values and leadership framework?
Well, one of the things about our approach to leadership is that we don't tend to put it in neat boxes. We have our five dimensions. As you know, they're not even equal in size. Some have more components than others. We recognise that there's an overlap. And it's a bit like, are you a leader or are you a manager? You are who you are and you do your best in the circumstances with the information you have available to you. So do you go into work saying it's a visionary day today? Oh no, I'll be more of a catalyst. No, so many of us react, and I think that's one of the problems with any sort of description of this somewhat simplistic way of describing leaders. We all like to be what we all like to be, and it's challenging whether that's suitable for the situations we find ourselves in. But to me, the most powerful suggestion here is the leader as coach. Because if you recognise that your role is to coach and not provide answers, then other visionaries, catalysts and architects can come forward and create the solution together. And reminds me of a blog that's been written by Judy Sims, where she's challenging this notion of the omnipotent leader. Even if you recognise the different roles that leaders have to play, very difficult, I think, to change by yourself. It's the people around you that are going to determine whether it's successful or not.
Thank you very much, Kate. And of course, this fits in with the Institute's Coaching Conversations initiative.
Absolutely. It's that recognition that if you coach the people around you, rather than trying to provide the answers for everybody, you're going to get much better solutions.
Okay, thank you, Kate. Our final story looks at the recent Business in the Community's National Mental Health at Work survey, Time to Take Ownership. The report states that all UK employees need to commit to improving the well-being of their people and that leaders need to take ownership of the impact their organisations have on mental health and support their staff appropriately. The report finds, for example, that 39% of employees have experienced poor mental health due to work or where work was a contributing factor in the past year, increasing from 36% for 2017 and 2018. Key concerns highlighted by the report include 79% of LGBT plus people are likely to have experienced poor mental health due to work or where work was a contributing factor, and 32% have hid or disguised that at work in the last year for fear of discrimination. 24% of LGBT plus employees with disabilities reported being encouraged to hide their sexual orientation by work colleagues, compared to 6% of those without a disability. Kate, what more can organisations do to acknowledge and support employees experiencing poor mental health, whatever the cause?
I think these statistics about the exclusion, essentially, of LGBT plus community, it's not surprising, is it, that it has a negative impact on mental health, because you don't feel you belong, which is what we were saying right at the beginning when we were looking at the racism at work. If the jokes, the day-to-day interactions are predominantly able-bodied heterosexual ones, then anybody who is different will feel so other. And that's where we really have to address inclusivity. And of course, the line manager is really important, and a recognition that work can impose additional stress on people. And it's for the managers to look out for that, to recognise it, and as, of course, all of these people advocate have time to talk.
Well, thank you very much, Kate. And is there anything else you would like to tell us that is happening in the Institute at the moment?
Well, I'd like to say thank you to all of our listeners from all over the world. But this is a special message for people in South Wales or North Wales or even in the southwest of England. We have a conference 31st of October in South Wales. Details on our website. Please come along. It would be great to see you.
Excellent. That is good news. Well, thank you, Kate. And that does conclude this week's episode. Listeners can find further topical content in the News and Views section on the Institute's website at www.institutelm.com. And thank you once again, Kate, for your insights on these stories.
Thank you, Rog.